customers one-stop shopping for information transmission services, long distance and local voice and data via both phone and internet, and multimedia services requiring broadband. Offering these services, however, would require AT&T to have direct access to customers. But that access lay in the hands of the regional telephone companies that had been divested from AT&T under the 1984 breakup of the old telephone monopoly. The company weighed several options, ranging from building its own local infrastructures in key metropolitan areas to buying cable companies. The strategy that Armstrong shaped had four building blocks. 1. Buying cable companies to gain direct, physical access to consumers. 2. Providing customers with bundled service, which would let AT&T claim a larger share of their communications wallet than its rivals could. 3. Executing the moves fast enough to generate revenue growth that would offset the decline in long-distance revenues. And 4. Relying on regulatory implementation of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which was supposed to block local telecoms from competing in long distance until they opened their networks fully to long distance carriers. It was a highly appealing strategy. The security analysts bought into the idea, and the initial market response was positive. Yet the strategy failed utterly. In December 2001, the company sold the cable holdings, for which it had paid $100 billion, to Comcast for $44 billion in equity and the assumption of $25 billion in debt. The move left the company essentially where it was when it started, and AT&T stock was trading at around $18. What went wrong? For the strategy to succeed, all four of the building blocks had to be sound, but all turned out to be based on faulty assumptions. AT&T Broadband was composed of two high-profile acquired cable companies, TCI and Media One, and some existing lines of business. The cable acquisitions were costly. AT&T paid top dollar for them and then some. At the same time, long-distance prices declined faster than assumed. And as they did, the company's stock price fell too. This made the acquisitions even costlier and added a huge amount of debt to the balance sheet. Consumers weren't as interested in bundled services as AT&T had expected, and the company did not market the proposition well or soon enough. It took AT&T much longer to execute its plan than it had anticipated. Finally, the regulators didn't enforce the Telecommunications Act as well as AT&T had hoped, which meant that the company took a double hit. Local phone companies entered the long-distance market, and long-distance carriers got less local access than the plan presumed. AT&T also made some critical people choices badly. Three sets of executives ran the cable businesses over a three-year period, none of them very effectively. The stock price was dealt another blow when major investors such as CalPERS, the retirement system for California public employees, and TIAA-CREF, the retirement system for teachers, voiced their dissatisfaction with execution at broadband. AT&T's strategy was disconnected from both external and internal realities. It didn't test its critical assumptions to see if they were robust, and it had no alternative plan for what to do if one or more of them proved wrong. The company did not take into account its organizational inability to compete against aggressive rivals in a fast-moving marketplace. Its culture, which was not much changed from the old monopoly days, could not execute well enough or fast enough to make the plan work soon enough. The building blocks of a strategy. The substance of any strategy is summed up by its building blocks, the half dozen or fewer key concepts and actions that define it. Pinpointing the building blocks forces leaders to be clear as they debate and discuss the strategy. It helps them judge whether the strategy is good or bad and why. It provides a basis for exploring alternatives if needed. If the building blocks are clearly defined, the essence of even the most complex strategy can be expressed on one page. For example, in 1991, a $500 million business unit of an industrial company, a supplier to major auto manufacturers, was barely breaking even. Its product was considered a commodity and was under continued pricing pressure from its customers. The unit developed a new strategy based on three building blocks. The first was to lower costs by moving production out of the United States to a network of plants well positioned to serve both global customers and local markets. The second was to continually redesign the product to achieve technological differentiation, which would add value and command higher prices. The third was to create a new organizational structure staffed with carefully selected management teams. Marketing remained localized, but product development, technology, manufacturing, and finance were made into global organizations. The unit executed all three of these building blocks simultaneously, and it achieved excellent margins and returns. Today, it is the supplier of choice for the world's top 10 automotive customers. Throughout the process, the unit's leaders kept in touch with reality. For example, the original plan called for moving the technology program from the United States to a lower-cost country. But when American engineers balked at making the move, it abandoned this idea. The leaders also kept the strategy up to date, reviewing the plan three times a year and refining it as conditions changed. The focus of this chapter is on business unit strategy, but it's important to understand the distinction between strategy at the business unit level and strategy at the corporate level. Corporate-level strategy is the vehicle for allocating resources among all of the business units. But it should not be simply the sum of those parts. If it is, then the business units could do just as well standing on their own, or better, since they wouldn't bear the burden of corporate overhead. Corporate leaders must add value to strategies created at the business unit level. At GE, for example, the boundarylessness that Jack Welch introduced assures a constant exchange of ideas and best practices among diverse business managers, significantly multiplying the company's intellectual capital. A corporate strategy also defines the walls of a company, the businesses it wants to be in, and the general arena of play. Honeywell, for example, is an industrial company. Consumer products won't play well in this arena, no matter how exciting they may be. Corporate-level strategy analyzes the mix of businesses and makes decisions about whether the mix should change in order to earn the best sustainable return on the company's capital. For example, GE exited the aerospace business when the Reagan presidency ended, anticipating the relative decline in defense expenditures and a fast consolidation of the industry. Jack Welch thought that financial and managerial resources would earn greater returns elsewhere. Strategic value is also added by initiatives to improve performance throughout the company, such as Six Sigma, digitization, and implementation of a good people process. GE's celebrated people process started as a Jack Welch initiative for human resources to produce a systematic way of assessing talent that would help develop future leaders. More recently, GE has formalized the search for GE Diamonds in the Rough, people of substance who may not have the polish of some of their peers and who might get overlooked at other companies. They may be struggling in their current jobs because of circumstances they cannot control, such as working for a bad boss. The initiative will help move these people to better environments where they can grow and be ready to take on more responsibility in the future. Building the strategic plan. When a business unit creates its strategy, it clearly lays out in specific terms the direction of the unit, where it is now, where it will be going in the future, and how it will get there. It looks at the cost of the strategic results it wants to achieve in terms of the capital resources it needs, analyzes the risks that are involved, and instills flexibility in case new opportunities arise or the plan fails. The strategy statement elucidates the positioning of the business in the context of its market segment map and analyzes the strengths and weaknesses of competitors. A business unit strategy should be less than 50 pages long and should be easy to understand. Its essence should be describable in one page in terms of its building blocks, as we've shown for AT&T and the automotive parts manufacturer. If you can't describe your strategy in 20 minutes, simply and in plain language, you haven't got a plan. But, people may say, I've got a complex strategy. It can't be reduced to a page. That's nonsense. That's not a complex strategy. It's a complex thought about the strategy. The strategy itself isn't complex. Every strategy ultimately boils down to a few simple building blocks.
A good strategic plan is a set of directions you want to take. It's a roadmap lightly filled in so that it gives you plenty of room to maneuver. You get specific when you're deciding the action part of the plan, where you link it with people and operations.
Who builds the plan? To be effective, a strategy has to be constructed and owned by those who will execute it, namely the line people. Staff people can help by collecting data and using analytical tools, but the business leaders must be in charge of developing the substance of the strategic plan. They know the business environment and the organization's capabilities because they live with them. They're in the best position to introduce ideas, to know which ideas will work in their marketplace and which ones won't, to understand what new organizational capabilities may be needed, to weigh risks, to evaluate alternatives, and to resolve critical issues that planning should address but too often doesn't. Not everyone can learn to be a good strategic thinker, of course, but by working in a group, guided by a leader who has a comprehensive understanding of the business and its environment, and by using the robust dialogue that's central to the execution culture, they all can contribute something, and all will benefit from being part of the dialogue. A good strategy process is one of the best devices to teach people about execution. It makes the mind better at detecting change. Pieces of paper don't do that. People learn about the business and the external environment, not just data and facts, but how to analyze it and use judgment. How is the plan put together? How is it synchronized? They discover insights and develop their judgments and intuition. They learn from mistakes. Why, when we made our assumptions, did we not see the changes that overtook us? Discussing these things creates excitement and alignment. In turn, the energy that these discussions build strengthens the process.
The leader of a business has to own the strategy development. He doesn't have a strategic planner do all the work, then come in and introduce himself to the subject the day it's being presented. He takes responsibility for the construction of the plan and gets some help, and then, once everyone agrees with the strategy, he takes responsibility for developing action plans. To start the planning process at Honeywell, I call the head of each unit, along with the strategic planner in his place, and maybe one of the corporate staffers, and we get agreement on the critical issues confronting the plan. After the plan has been constructed, but before I review it at the corporate level, each leader will have reviewed that plan with his subordinates and gotten their input on it. After all, these are the people who will have to implement the plan.
Questions for a strategic plan.
The strategic plans for Honeywell's businesses give special attention to environment, competition, and why some companies in a particular business are more successful than others. A plan will start off with a database that talks about the health of the business's environment. Is it a growth market or not? If the business is in an environment that's growing at, say, 2% annual rate, it's not going to grow at much above that level unless it has a new product or strategy that's truly unique. The Honeywell automotive business, for example, is in a low-growth environment, so we are cautious about our expectations for it and the amount of resources we allocate to it. The strategic plan then lays out the market share for that business, indicating whether it is in a leading or an insignificant position. Market share is the ultimate scorecard, and obviously it will influence the strategy. If the business's share is small and it's in a high-growth environment, the plan will lay out what it can do to improve market share. It will also detail whether the business has gained or lost market share in the past year. The strategic plan also contains a short synopsis of the strengths and weaknesses of each major competitor to the business. People have to understand that the world isn't going to watch and wave while they do something. Competitors are going to do something too. In the Honeywell avionics business, the competitive analysis focuses on companies like Rockwell Collins and France's Thalon. The plan then explores what kind of companies are successful in the environment of that business. Are they low cost? Do they have innovative technologies, expansive distribution systems, a global footprint? In other words, what separates the successful companies from the other companies in the same industry? You don't just put a plan together and then go back and see whether it can be of help to you. Decide on the objectives at the beginning. What do you want to get done? What are the critical issues we need to understand better? Why at the end is it going to be helpful to us? As you fill in the plan around these objectives, you've got a chance to accomplish something.
A strong strategic plan must address the following questions. What is the assessment of the external environment? How well do you understand the existing customers and markets? What is the best way to grow the business profitably, and what are the obstacles to growth? Who is the competition? Can the business execute the strategy? Are the short-term and long-term balanced? What are the important milestones for executing the plan? What are the critical issues facing the business? How will the business make money on a sustainable basis? What is the assessment of the external environment? Every business operates within a shifting political, social, and macroeconomic context, and the strategic plan must explicitly state the external assumptions that management is making. The leaders of a business unit have to scrutinize its environment carefully and understand it well. They should examine everything from economic and demographic trends and regulatory shifts to new technologies, alliances between competitors, the drivers of increasing or decreasing demand for its products, and so forth. AT&T's assessment of its external environment failed to anticipate that regulators might not behave as it hoped, and that the capital market boom in dot-coms, telecommunications, and media might not remain strong. The general environment is the same for every player. What differentiates the successful ones are their insights, perceptions, and abilities to detect patterns of change and relate them to their landscape, industries, competition, and business. For example, when the Asian contagion hit in 1997, most companies failed to detect the change until about March 1998. GE and Allied Signal saw it before the end of 1997 and changed their 1998 operating plans to be able to deliver the results they'd promised despite the new circumstance. Very few other companies responded adequately to the crisis. How well do you understand the existing customers and markets? Perhaps not as well as you think. When it comes to industrial customers, for example, the buying decision is more complex than just the customer's purchasing manager who negotiates prices. The division manager of a large industrial company recently proposed a growth strategy requiring a $300 million capital investment. The strategy would adapt an existing technology to a new product that would be sold to a new set of customers. The plan he proposed was elegant in the way it answered the usual strategy questions with data about the competition, the industry, and the external environment. The CEO listened patiently for 20 minutes, an unusually long period of time for him. However, he couldn't wait any longer to ask the following questions. First, who buys this product? The division manager answered that it was the purchasing managers of customer companies. The CEO said, "Really? Let me rephrase the question. Who specifies that this product should be purchased?" The division manager answered that it was obviously the engineers. The CEO's final question, delivered in a stern tone, was, "How many engineers did you talk to?" The dead silence meant that the project was rejected. People tend to look at their businesses from the inside out. That is, they get so focused on making and selling their products that they lose awareness of the needs and buying behaviors of their customers. The issue is simply understanding the specific people who make the purchasing decisions and their buying behavior. At large industrial companies, for example, engineers and purchasing agents usually do the buying. But in small companies, the CFO or even the CEO will be involved because they have to pay close attention to cash flow. This requires taking a significantly different approach to the customer. What is the best way to grow the business profitably, and what are the obstacles to growth? Does your business need to develop new products? Does it need to take existing ones into new channels and to new customers? Does it need to acquire other businesses? How are its costs compared with those of its competitors? And what productivity programs do you have in place to improve your cost position? In the early 1990s, GE Medical, the medical systems business of GE, hit the wall in the United States. It experienced no growth because reimbursement policies were discouraging hospitals from buying new equipment. The business unit manager, John Trani, and his team developed a growth plan to move into adjacent segments and supply maintenance and other services to owners of medical equipment, whether sold by GE or by competitors. There were obstacles. Some of the non-GE medical equipment was far removed from GE Medical's own high-tech diagnostic machinery, and the unit would have to persuade potential customers that its proposition had value. The unit overcame the first obstacle by acquiring a company specializing in the lower-tech equipment that GE didn't make, and by focusing on process improvement to increase the productivity of its own people. It overcame the second by taking an entrepreneurial gamble on a small hospital in Ohio. It contracted to maintain all of the equipment and guaranteed the hospital that it would save money. Once it succeeded, GE Medical was able to go to potential customers with a track record. That original growth initiative shifted a steadily increasing portion of GE Medical's revenues into high-margin services with higher levels of cash flow. One tool that's useful in defining growth opportunities is market segment mapping. The tool is simple enough. Any business can be segmented. Many consumer goods companies use it to great advantage, but many more don't. And neither do all but a few industrial companies. Planners will talk about market segments, but fewer than 5% of the plans we've seen contain any useful mapping. To understand how it works, let's look at A.T. Cross's segmentation of the luxury pen market. A simple map of Cross's market segments identifies three different consumers. The first is the individual who wants to buy such a pen for herself. The second is the person who buys one as a gift for another individual. and the third is the corporation that buys thousands with its logo on them and uses them as institutional gifts. For each market segment, the product is essentially the same, but demand is different, and so is the strategy. Each requires Cross to deal with different competitors, channels, economics, and pricing. A new market segment in the aircraft industry has recently changed the dynamics for manufacturers and suppliers. In the past 7 or 8 years, as commercial airline service and schedules deteriorated and prices rose, the corporate jet business has taken off. In 1996, Executive Jets pioneered fractional ownership, which is time-sharing in the sky, with its NetJet program. The new segment it created rapidly became the fastest-growing one in the business. Among manufacturers, the big winner was Bombardier of Canada, because Bombardier built planes that were right for the market, larger than the ones made by rivals such as Beech Aviation and Cessna, and smaller than those of Boeing or McDonnell Douglas and foreign competitors. Who is the competition? Sometimes businesses miss the emergence of new competitors who have more attractive value propositions for their customers. For example, while Staples, Office Depot, and Office Max were competing with one another, they failed to see the inroads that Walmart was making into the discount office supplies market. All three have since been losing share, and their stock prices have declined as a result.
Most often, companies underestimate their competitors' responses. One December, I had a call from a CEO of a $5 billion company. He said, "I announced 9 months ago that we will show earnings of $5 a share for the coming year. But the way things are going now, we won't do better than $3.50. It's a good market, and demand is not declining. I'm very embarrassed." We spent a day together, and here's what we learned. One key division was responsible for the company's failure to meet its earnings forecast. The person who was running it was brilliant and very interpersonal, a top scholar at Harvard Business School who had worked for a leading consulting group. He had been in this company 5 years. Though it hadn't been announced, he was generally understood to be the successor CEO. His strategy was to gain market share by cutting prices. He had been adding capacity over the past 3 years, which consumed a lot of cash since the industry is capital intensive and has thin profit margins. He calculated that his increased volume from cutting prices would lower costs significantly. When the CEO reviewed it, the strategy made sense to him. We went over all this, and finally I asked, "So what did you miss?" By then the CEO had figured it out. I did not ask him what the competitor's reaction would be, he said. "The biggest competitor matched the price cuts almost immediately, and the others followed. Prices for the entire industry went down. The company had the largest share and got hurt the worst." The CEO replaced the division head, and the new man he brought in gradually rolled the prices back up, initiated productivity programs, and reduced costs. The competitors followed the price increases, and by the end of the next year, the CEO had made his $5 a share. Sometimes people have the opposite problem. They overestimate the competition because they haven't asked the right questions, and they miss the opportunities they should be grasping. For example, I was working with a small player in the software industry. Its product was excellent. It is at the center of the bundle of software packages that enable appliances to connect with one another and the Internet, but the company was going nowhere with it. As I talked to its leaders, it emerged they were so terrified of Microsoft, they were pulling their punches. Microsoft did not have a competing product. But every time they did an analysis of the competition, they would say, "Once Microsoft hears about what we are doing, they will come after us with all of those resources." What they did not understand was that Microsoft actually had a lousy record of execution in their area. They knew how to execute. If this moved fast to get key initial customers who would be references for other customers, they could take firm control of the market. The company went ahead and is now succeeding. To execute is still better. It is also changing its organizational structure. and changing key people in both sales and design. It is refocusing the sales force to attack multiple segments and improve cycle time.
Can the business execute the strategy? An astonishing number of strategies fail because leaders don't make a realistic assessment of whether the organization can execute the plan. This was one of the problems at Xerox, Lucent, and AT&T. Another example is Joe, the CEO we talked about at the beginning of Chapter 1. The man could not understand why his carefully planned strategy failed, and he was about to be fired as a result. He and his leadership team would never have been in that position if they had assessed their organization's capabilities. They would have found that it fell far short of being able to execute the strategy. The top two layers of the leadership ranks did not have enough people who met their commitments. The manufacturing people didn't know how to improve process flow in their plants, which meant that the product didn't get out as it should have. Manufacturing also lacked continuous improvement processes, so they could not deliver the consistent cost and quality improvements that buyers expected. Finally, they had little capability to work with suppliers to reduce costs early in the supply chain, an issue for many manufacturing companies, by the way. How do you make such an assessment in your business? In a sense, this shouldn't even be a question. If you're doing your job as a leader, if you're intimately involved in the three core processes, running the robust dialogues that permit candid assessments, you can't help but have an idea of your capabilities. But don't stop there. Listen to your customers and your suppliers. Get all your leaders to do the same and ask them to report what they've heard. And don't forget the security analysts who look at you sharply from the outside. Some are good, some aren't. But after a while, you will know which ones you can learn from.
You measure your organizational capability by asking the right questions. If your strategy requires a worldwide manufacturing capacity, for example, you need to ask, do we have people with global experience? Do we have people who know how to source? Do we have people who can run a supply chain that extends worldwide? On a scale of 1 to 10, if your answers come up a 6, you don't have enough capability. If you have a mechanical engineering business that's going toward electronics, as most of them are, how much depth of people and experience in electronics do you have? Do you have the capability in chip technology or in information technology? If software is going to be embedded in the product, do you have enough software people? And if your answer is an 8 or a 7, what do you need to do to get to a 10? Do you have people who understand Six Sigma, for example, and have achieved at least 5 Sigma? Engineering organizations are often not on the cutting edge of their field's discipline. Can you put a new product in and expect that your people will step up to the bar and respond? If the answer is no, you need to search for new talent or take other corrective action, such as executing a marketing agreement with someone who can make the product. In finance, you need a basic cost accounting activity, or do you need a more sophisticated capability that can handle things you have to do globally, such as hedging? You can certainly increase your capability. You're looking at it not just today, but 2 years out. But what you distill and gain from the process is an understanding of what needs to be done.
What are the important milestones for executing the plan? Milestones bring reality to a strategic plan. If the business doesn't meet milestones as it executes the plan, leaders have to reconsider whether they've got the right strategy after all. In the Honeywell automotive business mentioned earlier, the short and medium-term milestones were to develop programs to move to low-cost manufacturing locations, as well as to create and execute a technology map to differentiate the product and increase margins. The long-term, 5-year-plus, mission was to position the business so that it could break out of the auto industry and adapt the technology to serve customers in other markets. A good strategic plan is adaptable. Once-a-year planning can be dangerous, especially in short-cycle businesses where markets won't wait on your planning schedule. Periodic interim reviews can help you to understand what's happening and what turns in the road are going to be necessary. This is another reason your business leaders have to be in on the plan from the beginning. Because they helped build it and they own it, they carry it around in their heads all the time, unlike a staff-driven planning book, which will spend a year on shelves before being discarded. So they can regularly test it against reality. And because you've crystallized the essence, it doesn't take too long to implement changes. Are the short-term and the long-term balanced? Strategy planning needs to be conducted in real time, connected to shifts in the competitive environment and the business's own changing strengths and weaknesses. This means defining the mission in the short to medium term as well as in the long term. Breaking the mission down into these chunks will help bring reality to the plan. Thinking about what will deliver results in the short and medium term will give you an anchor to build for the future. Anything from customer preferences to cash flows can change in mere moments. Businesses have to prepare themselves to adapt to an economy of constant change. In developing your plan, you need to look ahead to landscapes that are more likely than not to change before your plan can come to fruition. If, for example, you decide to move some of your plants to low-cost countries, it's not necessary to decide on which plants too far in advance. Opening a plant in, say, China may be attractive now, but a year from today, it may not be the best alternative. The point is, first to get the principle across. In this case, the need to reduce costs by moving some part of the operation to a new locale. Then make a concrete decision as you move closer to the date. Balancing the short run with the long run is thus a critical part of a strategic plan. Most plans don't address what a company has to do between the time the plan is drawn up and the time it is supposed to yield peak results. A plan that doesn't deal with the near-term issues of costs, productivity, and people makes getting from here to there unacceptably risky and often impossible.
You can't just say mañana. You've got to have a plan that both plants seeds and harvests, that can make your financial objectives in the short term as well as do things that extend the life of the business in the longer term. One manager, Jerry, introduced a plan that looked like a hockey stick. Earnings initially dropped from the operating losses, but then rose sharply. He said, "We're going to have flat earnings for 3 years while we get this strategy launched." I said to him, "Jerry, I can't have flat earnings for the company for 3 years, so who's going to make up the difference? If you want to engage in something that's got a substantial operating loss aspect to it, then it's incumbent upon you to explain how you're going to fill this so-called bathtub between now and when this project becomes profitable. If you can't overcome it, then the enthusiasm for investing in that project is diminished." When you press people on this kind of issue and make it clear that you're not going to give them an earnings holiday while they get their project going, the amount of imagination and innovation that occurs is remarkable. Jerry came back and said, "I can take more profit out of this product line in the short term because I don't think its long-term potential is that good anyway. And I can sell off a small business and make a profit because I don't think it's the best business for us to be in. I can cut expenses by 10% during this period as a way to generate more earnings. I can do 4 or 5 things that can overcome this loss from the new product." One important result that comes out of this approach is that the whole business team owns the new project now. Since everybody's making some kind of contribution to support it, everybody is committed to it.
Intel mastered the art of balancing the short term and the long term from the time it was a $200 million company. They understood that to win in their game, They must invest in improving manufacturing processes and equipment ahead of the new generation technology so it can be tested. That way they are ready for the next generation, thus meeting short-term goals and also building for the longer run. Achieving this balance requires creativity and idea generation, finding resources outside the corporation if necessary for the long term. That is common now in the pharmaceutical industry. Warner Lambert, in developing the cholesterol-lowering drug Lipitor, needed resources as well as more extensive sales coverage globally. It negotiated with Pfizer to co-fund development and launch the molecule underlying Lipitor. Warner Lambert got a $250 million check from Pfizer, thus gaining resources from outside, and at the same time improving its market position with more sales coverage. Every year companies such as Colgate-Palmolive and Emerson Electric generate resources that build for the future through productivity improvement programs. Colgate is one of the very best examples of a company that delivers short-term results quarter after quarter. It has an enviable record of increasing margins every year and out-competing its major competitors in earnings growth, sales, and cash generation. Not only does its total toothpaste product line make it number one in sales and market share, but its consistent practices every year to develop and execute productivity programs funds the growth projects of the future. Unique among consumer goods companies, Colgate now has a global group working on ideas for growth and productivity.
What are the critical issues facing the business? Every business has half a dozen or so critical issues, the ones that can badly hurt it or prevent it from capitalizing on new opportunities or reaching its objectives. Addressing these usually requires research and thought. Delineating the critical issues in the strategic plan helps focus the preparation and dialogue when it comes time to review the strategy.
At Honeywell, in the phone calls I have with managers before a review, I'll ask them what they think the critical issues are. I'll tell them what I think the issues are, not because my views are necessarily different, but because we have to have a clear understanding about what the strategic plan needs to address. Later, we'll get on the phone again and have an iteration of these four or five issues. Finally, I'll say, go through your plan and make sure that we can answer these questions when we have the review. When it comes time to do the review, we'll start the meeting with the issues we've identified. The managers will give some data, of course, how big the business is, what market share they have, how fast the market is growing, who their competitors are. Then we'll talk about what growth and productivity programs we foresee over the next 3 years. But the focus is on issues that encumber the business as well as opportunities that we should spend some time trying to capitalize on. For example, we identified three critical issues for one of our automotive products in 2002. We weren't doing as well as expected in Japan. How could we improve performance there? What would be the next technological evolution of the product? It's in a high-tech market that is changing rapidly. And how could we grow the aftermarket more quickly? You also have to know what issues to leave out of the discussion. Let's say the question comes up of whether we should build a plant to produce a new product. That question is appropriate for inclusion in the plan, but we shouldn't make a decision without enough detail to really make that judgment as carefully as we can. We may have two or three of these kinds of issues. I want to review the whole plan and then hold a separate session to resolve those big issues. These unmentionable issues are potentially embarrassing to open in front of other people. Most involve management failure. The Xerox story discussed in Chapter 2 is an example. The highly indebted company's huge consumption of cash and its loss of market share brought it to a financial crisis in the year 2000 because management failed in the execution of its plans to reorganize the sales force by industry and to consolidate its administrative centers. Critical issues such as these need to be the subject of robust dialogue during the building of the plan. If problems arise, they should be placed on the table for discussion by including them in the plan. Why did we lose market share last year in this business for a key product? Why can't we achieve higher productivity? Why can't we grow more rapidly in China? Why do we continue to have quality problems? How can we continue to grow our market? You burrow through 5 or 6 issues to provide data and make recommendations, and ultimately you achieve a resolution. That's part of a productive strategic planning exercise.
Many strategies fall apart because the right critical issues aren't raised. AT&T's critical issues included the decline in long-distance revenues and the organizational capability to execute a major shift in strategy. The Iridium Consortium, the joint effort of Motorola and TRW to develop a satellite telecommunications system able to link phones worldwide, confronted 2 critical issues. One was how to create enough demand to bring prices down enough to build a sizable market. The other, related to the first, was to develop handheld units small enough that consumers would be able to conveniently carry them around. The strategy failed on both counts. In 2001, Dell Computer was beginning to face its critical issue, the dim long-term outlook for PCs. No matter how much market share Dell stood to gain, the market had no foreseeable heady growth. An initial step in the right direction was to form an alliance with EMC to market EMC's storage equipment. A stronger option was to expand into the adjacent segment, servers, where the growth potential is far higher than for PCs. But can Dell's low-margin, high-velocity model, which works so well for PCs, be effective with more technologically sophisticated servers? As this program is being produced, the jury is still out. At the level of the business unit, the issues are smaller in scope but are no less critical to the organization's future. For example, in the Honeywell Automotive unit, these were some of the critical issues raised in the 2001 plan. 1. Can we continue to have costs low enough to still make adequate margins in continually declining prices in the automotive segment? What does it take for us to be ahead of the curve on costs? 2. Should the leadership team consider shifting manufacturing to a low-cost location like China? What are the risks in taking such a step? 3. What are the regulatory issues? Are we aware of any negatives? And if so, what are we going to do about them? Are we doing enough to support tighter restrictions on auto emissions, which will increase demand for the product? How will the business make money on a sustainable basis? Every strategy must lay out clearly the specifics of the anatomy of the business, how it will make money now and in the future. That means understanding the following foundations, the mix of which is unique for every business: the drivers of cash, margin, velocity, revenue growth, market share, and competitive advantage. For example, the division manager we discussed earlier, who was proposing a $300 million investment for a new product, would need to present the following information to answer the question about how his strategy for the product would make money and provide adequate return on investment. 1. Pricing at different levels of demand. Will the customer pay a premium for what you claim is a differentiation? 2. Cost and cost structure now and in the future. 3. Cash required for working capital. 4. Actions required to ramp up revenue growth. 5. The investment required to market the product. 6. Continued investments in technologies to prepare for the next generation of product. 7. Competitors' pricing reactions. By now, we hope you can see that a strategic plan contains ideas that are specific and clear. It is not a numbers exercise. Numbers are obviously needed, But those that are detailed line by line and are mechanically extrapolated over 5 years offer little in the way of insight. The numbers you need are those that add to the robustness of the ideas in the strategic plan. The questions are not mechanical either. The ones that are important will vary from situation to situation and from year to year. So will the answers. What's right for one business today may not be right for another business or for the same business. A plan prepared according to the guidelines and questions outlined in this chapter provides the foundation for a robust dialogue linking the strategy to the people and operating processes. That dialogue takes place during the review of strategy detailed in the next chapter. Chapter 8. How to conduct a strategy review. Maybe you've sat through one or more strategy reviews like this one. The participants gather. The planners bring out the big fat book they've assembled and go through it page by page in show-and-tell mode, allowing little room for questions. The CEO will ask a few, to be sure. Often he's been prepped by the planning staff, so that he can show he has a grasp of the subject, and maybe nail a few people with gotchas. People struggle to stay awake through the deadly ritual. At the end of 4 hours, there's been little or no constructive discussion, and almost no decisions about which actions will advance the business. In fact, nobody really understands much of what they've heard. The critical issues don't stand out amid all the mind-numbing detail. People will take the books back to their offices, where they will end up as credenza-ware, gathering dust for the rest of the year. This is the business unit strategy review. It's how reviews were conducted at GE before Jack Welch took over more than 2 decades ago. Others have since adopted the style he brought to GE, ban the fat books, and get everybody thinking and talking about reality. But the message still hasn't really gotten out. Far too many reviews are dominated by dry discussions of numbers and by people maneuvering for power and ducking tough questions. This is no way to execute. The business unit strategy review is the prime social operating mechanism of the strategy process. It provides the penultimate ground for testing and validating the strategy, the last chance to get things right before the plan faces the ultimate test of the real world. As such, it has to be inclusive and interactive. It must feature a solid debate, conducted in the robust dialogue of the execution culture, with all of the key players present and speaking their minds. The review should be a creative exercise, not a drill where people regurgitate data. If creativity is absent from the conversation, the participants might as well stay in their offices. People have to leave with closure to the discussion and clear accountability for their parts in the plan. And the leader must follow through to be sure that everyone is clear about the outcome of the review.
My son Paul, a vice president for commercial equipment financing at GE Capital, came to me one day. He was going into his first planning session in this new position, and he asked, "Dad, what do you think they're looking for?" I told him, "They're looking for new ideas. Don't go in there and just have a reprise of last year's plan. Make your idea the best idea you can, and don't worry if someone says it's a bad idea. Make it a creative process where some new thinking happens that wouldn't otherwise have happened. That's an element of a good planning process. While you generally want to avoid the rearview mirror, focusing too much on last year's strategic plan, you should spend some time discussing how well it was executed. How close did you come to achieving its goals? I never ask people for a lot of numbers, just some trend numbers. But then you have to ask, are the trend numbers about the same, and did people do what they said they would do, or is this just another day in the life of things that don't happen? Search for ways to link as many of these events as possible as a basis for establishing credibility.
The strategy review is also a good place for a leader to learn about and develop people. You'll find out about their strategic thinking capabilities, both as individuals and as a group. At the end of the review, you'll have a good perspective on the people involved and an assessment about their potential for promotion. And you'll have had opportunities to coach people.